Accession number 13668, reel 2.
Mr. Adams, reel 2.
And the wheelbarrows were taken over by the two lads who'd escorted us through the woods, and we were joined by a couple of nurses on bicycles. And they indicated, Dutch nurses, they indicated to Tom and I that we should drive the bicycles, and they would sit on the carrier at the back. And in this way, we followed the dirt track by the main railway line all the way to the level crossing at Ada. Then we crossed over the level crossing and we were taken to the back entrance of a terrace of houses called Berkenland. And I think it was number 16. And it was there, this was the home of that wonderful woman, Edith Nyhoff. And as we came in the back, going out the front were three members of our 10th Battalion, which was a very chummy battalion so far as 156. We'd been together a long time. And one of those three, of course, was Fred Ventress Jenkins, whom I think you have heard about. And we were in that house with the Nyhoff family, not only with the Nyhoff family. They had friends who'd been evacuated from their houses on the Neder Rhine, eating there, if not sleeping there. I remember being the joy of having a hot bath and of actually sleeping without boots in a proper bed. And we were there for 2 or 3 weeks when we were visited by Tony Franks with, of course, Major... from the second bit, Digby Tatton Water. At that stage, it was the intention to distribute all the evaders. We learnt that there were about 70 or so of us to various parts of Holland to join up with the underground and to possibly train them in weaponry and that sort of thing. This was the original idea. However, about a week after that, we were visited again, and I was told I was to go and see a Digby Tatton Water who had instructions for me. So I said goodbye to Tom and the Nyhoffs, and by this time I'd been reunited with a bag which contained my uniform. I should have mentioned earlier that we were by now in civilian clothes. With my bag, off I went to Digby Tatton Water, where he was in hiding, and taken to a hut in the garden. And there, Tony Franks was there too. And he told me that the new instructions they had from the UK were that we were to be evacuated. The problem of evacuation was that whereas they were very confident of the underground between Ada and the Neder Rhine, they did not know and were not happy about the situation between the Neder Rhine and the Waal. And the route they had in mind would have taken us well to the west of Arnhem on a line, say, from Ada right the way down to to the east of Tiel, and then across and down to the Waal and across the Waal, somewhere in the area of Leuven. Anyway, I had my uniform with me. I was to go with this chap called Tony, and he would take me, and he would take me to Fabian, who was an SAS officer who had been dropped before Arnhem, and was our link, literally, with the UK. So a bicycle was provided, and off we set. And in due course, after having lunch at a farmhouse on the way, I ended up in this chicken coop where I found, to my surprise, three members of the SAS. They were, in fact, Belgium soldiers. I learned this because Fabian, who was Captain King, was a Belgian, and he said, you will know that I am not English, but from the way I speak. He says, but the Dutch don't know this, but it's in my best interest and in our best interest that they think that I am English, although I'm Belgian. So please don't disillusion them. And here he was operating, miles behind the lines, with these two Belgian colleagues, all in uniform. And I was then handed over to another guide, and I should perhaps explain that what I had been told to do by Digby Tatton Water was, once I'd crossed the Nederrhein, I was to do my best to organize a rat line, that's an escape line, between the Nederrhein and the Waal, which is, of course, the big, wide river that comes through Nijmegen and is of much greater significance than the Nederrhein, which is a small river by comparison. And that if I could persuade a British intelligence officer to come through the lines, I was to get on out myself. I was also instructed that once I had established a position between these two rivers, I was to wear my uniform. And that night, my escort had now changed to a rather charming young Dutch girl called Bep. That night, we stopped and I spent it at a Dutch farmhouse. They were careful, the farmer and his wife, to keep me under cover until their farm, the labourers and everything connected with the farm had sort of departed. Next morning, I was taken on by Bep to a meeting of a lot of couriers who were exchanging bits and pieces of information and intelligence in a wood. This is broad daylight. And on down to the Nederrhein, where we were waited, literally, for an illegal ferry, which was crossing the river right under the noses of the Germans all day long, as far as I could see. So we crossed over the Nederrhein in daylight again, and I was then taken to a house. It was afternoon by this time, for a cup of tea with a delightful old lady and the on the banks of the river in Dutch costume, and she asked me to sign a visitor's book. To my horror, I found it stuffed with the names of a variety of RAF pilots who'd obviously followed the same route. Then I was taken off again to what I was told was the headquarters of the underground. In this was, of course, by now south of the Nieder Rhine, to this house where I found, to my surprise, Peter Baker in civilian clothes, and this extraordinary American, Bottenheimer. And
what was that so extraordinary about him?
Who, Bottenheimer?
Yes.
Well, he was a very engaging sort of character. And I think he gave me the impression that he was playing a game of cowboys and Indians. So I found, which I found a little bit surprising. Having spoken to Baker, he says, well, he said, this is what I'm here for. I'm here for this purpose, you see. He was MI9. I knew he was British intelligence. I didn't know the which section or anything like that. He said, so there's a party going out tonight. You'd better go out with them. And that is what happened. That night, I joined this party of Dutchmen. It was a filthy night. We got down to the river, that's the Vaal this time, and to my surprise, there, waiting in this house by the side of the river, was a Belgian fighter pilot whose Spitfire, I think, had been knocked down about 48 hours earlier somewhere in the north of Holland. And he was to accompany me on this trip across the Rhine. The Vaal, rather. We got across the Vaal. We landed near Leuven. They then told me when I got there that there was a couple of British intelligence officers staying at a house further along the river. So I said, well, the sooner I got to see them, the better. And that night, the poor old car, which had a punctured wheel or anything, we got there, and about 3 o'clock in the morning, I think, I went into this bedroom, woke these two recumbent figures up, and lo and behold, one was Airy Neave, and the other was Hugh Fraser, who, of course, was Lovett's younger brother, and subsequently became a minister in the Majesty's government like Airy Neave did, had a distinguished political career, lovely bloke, very fond of Hugh. And Airy Neave, of course, he was a delightful man too. And that was it. And of course, the whole thing was cancelled subsequently because, for no other reason, the whole thing was blown. The next night, Peter Baker and his American pal were captured. The following night, after they were captured, Colonel Dobie, who had commanded the 1st Battalion, there was another evader, had commanded the 1st Parachute Battalion at Arnhem, came through with revised plans for Pegasus, the big one, the mass escape, which in fact took place across the Nieder Rhine at Arnhem, or just to the west of Arnhem. And then I was debriefed by another famous character, Squadron Leader A.J. Evans, who made his distinguished himself by making a very spectacular escape from prison camp in the First World War. And he debriefed me in Brussels. And I was also, funny, I was interviewed by Prince Bernhard, I suppose, because I'd been one of the first out, so I was, for a very short time, I suppose, a bit of sort of celebrity.
Where was it that you met Aaron Neave and Hugh Fraser?
On the banks of the Rhine at, if I can look up this a moment, we actually landed at the village of Dreumel, Dreumel. I think I said Leuven before, but it was Dreumel. Then we had landed at the village of Dreumel, which we found was not occupied by any Allied troops, but rather by a force of what could be termed Dutch irregulars. Their headquarters was in what must have been the village hall. They told me that as far as they were aware, the nearest British forces, in the shape of two British officers, were in a house a few miles up the river at the next village of Leuven. Naturally, having got so far, I wanted to complete my journey as soon as possible, quite apart from the fact that I was in possession of important military intelligence which needed to be passed on to the appropriate authorities with a minimum delay. Unfortunately, the only form of transport which the Dutch irregulars possessed was an old car with a flat tire, and they informed me that this could not be repaired until the morning. Apart from this vehicle, there was no means of getting in touch with the British officers. Never being the soul of patience, this last obstacle was too much for me. I said that I would drive the car, flat tire notwithstanding. What was more, I promised that I would arrange for the British Army to provide them with a replacement. This agreed. In the small hours of the morning, and in pouring rain, I took off accompanied by the Belgian fighter pilot and a guide. It was a filthy night, very dark, not a light in sight, and it seemed a long 3 miles driving, as I was on the rim of the wheel with a flat tire, and along a road which had not received any maintenance for several years. We duly arrived at the house where the two officers were staying, and I was shown into a room with the two recumbent figures, both fast asleep. I put the light on and woke them up. They introduced themselves as Major Airy Neave, who was already famous for his remarkable escape from Colditz, and Major Hugh Fraser, who was the brother of Lord Lovett, the well-known commander.
So it was at Leuven.
Leuven? Leuven. Leuven, that's right. Leuven. Mm-hmm. And, as I say, I was then interviewed by... what are we...
You said you were talking about being interviewed by Prince Bernhard.
That's right.
You
yeah,
said because you were the first, one of the first...
Yes, one of the first ones, yes. And then I was home on leave and... I was subsequently recalled by the general, I think largely because apart from that extraordinary character, Leo Heaps, you may have heard of, and I was one of the first to get out. But in the meantime, the great Pegasus escape had taken place, so... all that happened was that I was on the aerodrome in the Lincolnshire, wherever it was, to meet them as the great escapers from the big Pegasus operation landed. The next thing I knew was I was seconded to IS-9, which is the operational end of MI-9, And obviously, I took the vacancy caused by the capture of Peter Baker.
What were you supposed to be doing, precisely?
Well, there were still a lot of evaders behind the lines. So it was necessary to continue a presence. There were two teams from IS-9. One was Canadian, and they were operating on the Canadian Army's front, which was further down below the Beezerbosch. And my team, which had been for me Peter Baker's, presumably, which operated from Nijmegen, roughly. And we spent the rest of the war with, I must admit, very little success in putting people through, agents through, and trying and assist getting evaders and escapers out. I say not with much success, because by this time the lines had become very much more static, and it was much more difficult for civilians to operate or for evaders to be got out. And we had all sorts of things to assist us. For example, we had these marvelous canoes, which had a silenced outboard motor, three separate watertight compartments, each one of which was unsinkable for the simple reason that the interior of these boats, these canoes, was full of ping-pong balls. And so it didn't matter how many many times, virtually, their surface was broken, because the ballast was ping-pong balls. So you'd have had to burst quite a few ping-pong balls to make them sink.
Were you personally penetrating deep into into German-held territory?
No. I mean, basically, we were operating from Nijmegen as a base, and we were much more concerned with the Vaal, to the west end of the Vaal, because by this time we'd really retreated from the banks of the Nader Rhine, and we just had a presence which consisted of not as much as a division, probably a brigade, in what we call the island, going up possibly as far as Elst. Then there was a sort of no man's land. It's difficult to describe, because the dikes had been breached, and so much of this territory was now underwater. For example, amongst our transport, we had a thing called a duck, and a seep, or rather a seep, which was a aquatic version of the of a jeep. In other words, you could put it into the river and and operate through a propeller instead of the wheels, and it was amphibious, great fun. And I say we had these marvelous canoes as well. We even had electric lilos, which was very thick rubber and black, with an electric motor on which you could operate, very invisible, absolutely invisible. But the problem was not that we could We had no problem about getting across the river, the Nieder Rhine, or for that matter the Waal, to the other side. The problem was getting the evaders down to the river, because by this time the lines had become pretty sort of steady and non-mobile, and so it was. And I think the Germans had subjected the Dutch to much greater restriction in their movement than we had known when we came across in September, October. I mean, we're talking about January, February. So we tried all sorts of things. I mean, we used to go up in Auster aircraft with S-phones. And you may have heard of these S-phones. Yes. Were very, very, very successful because, of course, they had such a short range they could be picked up on the ground. And although they could pick you up, signal up from the air. We used to go up in these Austers. So you had to sort of converse in questions. Say, we'll arrange a pickup, and we'd say to them on the ground, name a day, and they'd say, next Wednesday, and we'd say in the plane, add two, and repeat, and he'd say, Friday, and then you'd get the, because they couldn't pick him up from the ground, provided there was nobody within 100 yards of him on the ground, he couldn't be picked up. So this was a very useful means of communication. If we had a message to put across, we'd put that across in a very simple code. The chap who'd gone through, the agent, when he went through, would have been given a book, and we had the same book. Could have been any book. So you could say code 26. That would mean page 26 in the book. And then you'd say 55L20. That would be, page 55 would be the page in the book. L would be the, from starting with A, the L line down the page, and then across 15 would be the 15th letter in line L. And then he'd have to work all that out and come back with the answer for you at the next meeting. One thing I always remember about these Auster flights was being taken up by a major in the, because these were army spotters, a major in the artillery. And just as we were about to take up, a ground staff came along and said, "You've forgotten this, sir," and handed him a Sten gun. And I thought, this is most peculiar, and I said, "What on earth have you got a Sten gun for?" He said, "Well,